I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close, but not too close, reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope, gain for a poem, or poems that interest us, some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today, I'm happily joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Jessica Lowenthal, poet, teacher, editor, brilliant convener daily of Poetic Happenings, associate publisher of Jacket 2 magazine, and director of this very Kelly Writer's House, and author of As If in Turning. And the mom of a child with a smashed finger from a car door.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
That's probably the thing about your life you're most thinking about now, never mind that you published a book of poems. And by Michelle Taransky, whose 2013 book of poems is Sorry Was in the Woods, and whose 2008 collection Barn Burn Then won the Omni Dawn Poetry Prize that year, who teaches critical and creative writing here at Penn, is a dear, dear friend of the Kelly Writer's House community, and is the reviews editor at Jacket 2 magazine, and by Dee Morris, who has taught modern and contemporary poetics, including sound art, documentary, and the digital, among whose books are How to Live, What to Do, HD's Cultural Poetics, and Sound State's Innovative Poetics and Acoustical Technologies, a book, Dee, that is like a Bible around the offices of Penn Sound, and her co-edited collection, New Media Poetics, who has written tons of fabulous essays on writing the human-machine interface, on HD's time in Philadelphia, on storytellers, on Dickinson, on Adrian Rich, on oppositional intellectuals. Hello, Dee. Welcome back to the Writer's House.
Thank you, Al. It's great to be here.
I'm so glad that you're here. And this is like a weird reunion, isn't it? Somebody want to explain that?
You guys know
each other.
We do.
The three of you. What are the connections? Is there an Iowa connection or a Brown connection or what?
Iowa. I think we were both students of Dee. We were both.
You
Michelle
think you're
and
not?
I,
you don't. It was
well,
such
I mean,
impressive
we weren't there at
teaching
the same
that
time.
You.
We were.
Oh, you. I, the I thinking just, part is that you were together.
Yeah, we were both students of Dee at different times.
It was two wonderful classes. Yours was Sound States.
Sound States.
I ever did.
It was the first.
Yeah, that preceded that book. And Michelle, you were What else can poetry do?
Right.
Which is great courses.
Well, that course title I've taught under, which you gave me the permission to do at Penn, What Else Can Poetry Do?
So, Dee, you need to come out of retirement and teach a couple of those courses here. We would love it. Anyway, we're glad you're here today, and I'm very excited about this conversation, not simply because the three of you know each other and I won't get a word in edgewise, but because this is just great poetry. We're here today to talk about two short poems by Laureen Nitecker. The first is Wild Man, which when it was published after Nitecker's death was titled Wilderness. I kind of like the wilderness title, but anyway, we can talk more about that. The second is a poem called Foreclosure. The recording of these and other poems is precious, from a DIY recording made by Sid Corman, who was visiting Nitecker in Wisconsin in November of 1970. All the poems in the recording were posthumously published in Harpsichord and Saltfish by Pig Press in 1991. Both, of course, appear now in Jenny Penberthy's edition, a fine edition of the collected works of Nitecker. So here now, reading for her friend Sid Corman in 1970, is Laureen Nitecker performing Wild Man and Foreclosure.
Wild man, you are the man, you are my other country, and I find it hard going. You are the prickly pear, you are the sudden violent storm, the torrent to raise the river to float the wounded doe. Foreclosure. Tell him to take my bare walls down, my cement abutments, their parties thereof and claws of claws. Leave me the land, scratch out the land. May prose and property both die out and leave me peace.
Dee, you came the longest way for Poem Talk today, so you get to choose which poem we should talk about first.
Let's do Foreclosure.
Okay. Can you lay out the scene or situation? It may seem obvious, but it's worth talking about.
Well, I love how she begins with tell him. It's a typical kind of aggressive beginning that she's
who's
got.
Who's M? Who's them?
It must be the bankers, don't
yeah,
you think?
Yeah, the bankers, the people or the creditors, or the repo guys. Yeah.
Or people who believe in law. Right? Law and property.
Or legalese, anyway. Or
legalese.
So the situation is a foreclosure. The speaker is having to give up the house.
And what she's trying to do in some ways here, I think, is negotiate the terms of that release and keep the land.
Okay, so Jessica, take it from there. She tries to keep the land. Does she, in the end, keep the land, do you think?
I don't know how to answer except to say it's sort of unclear if she wants to keep the concept of property. So she wants to, whether or not she is on the land or part of the land, or she doesn't want to be in possession of the land.
Michelle, why would anyone, Nitaker aside, why would anybody in this situation say, take the house but leave the land? Why would that be?
Well, houses can have memories of certain events or relationships or rituals, and a land can be retread, rebuilt. Like a land can sort of have a new house on it and a new shed.
But in Nitaker's case, the house isn't much at all. Bare walls, cement, etc. Jessica?
But she actually says, leave me the land, yes, but then she says, scratch out the land.
Well, the way she reads it, she says, scratch out the land, but the way the poem is printed, it's scratch out colon the land, which leads you to read it another way. Dee?
It seems to me like what she's doing there is editing the document, right?
Scratch
so
out.
So leave me the land as a kind of plea, leave me the land, and then scratch out the land.
So it's either scratch out taking the land, or it's never mind, I don't even want the land. That's my reading. I read it as quite a radical poem where the negotiation ends up being take the house, take the land, may prose and property both die out. Leave me peace.
And leave me peace.
See?
I think one thing that's at work here is something that she felt very strongly that she took from Black Hawk, the Native American who was living nearby.
In Wisconsin,
that's right, in this sort of marshland, who said, things are, you can pick them up and take them away, like the concrete abutment, even you can get rid of that, but you can't get rid of the land. And if you live on the land, you basically own the land. Mm-hmm. It is your land. You've scratched out a living on that land.
Jessica, Dee is your teacher, your former teacher, but you and I have a different reading. You want to go a little further?
I think it was also Dee's reading moments ago that it scratch out quite literally is editing a document, and so we're editing the line "Leave me the land," or the legal document. You're scratching out the word "the land," and wanting therefore to take the land out of the concept of possession of. The thing that's going to keep you.
Michelle, there's a change of address here. At first, tell him, then leave me. Command language, scratch out. And then we get may, prose, and property. So it's prayer-like and pleading. What do you think?
So for me, that first tell him, I thought immediately of her poem, Write Down, where she talks about being right down among them. But that is her co-workers, I believe. And so to me, the way we've talked about this is different. It's the bankers, the property owners, those that are sort of keeping her in this place. I mean, there's laws around owning property, and foreclosure is something that might happen upon you. But I think for Nitaker, this idea of the land that she inherited from Black Hawk. The idea of the land that it was like sacred and important, and a lot of the things that were happening in Wisconsin to these lands were not things that she liked.
So property would be the house, but if you leave me the land, I don't consider that property. So it doesn't get...
Yeah, leave the land as it was, as it is.
Land is not owned.
Right.
People may not own land, so land is not property.
So why do we get a prayer? I'm reading it as prayer diction. Why do we get that at the end? Or what is it, Dee?
I would read it... as prayer diction, but subjunctive. I'm telling you, take my house, take the cement. I'm making fun of your language. The how she goes.
Parties thereof, there, claws of claws.
And claws of claws.
Yeah,
which
you
is
know, I,
great claw
like
back.
That. I, claw back. Oh, okay. I thought it was just cute, and it was like my least favorite line.
I hear it in terms of clawing back, the practice of clawing back.
Is
the
that,
bank
is that
in
a
foreclosure.
Is that a language of 1970? Do we still say that, clawing back?
I think, yes, I think so.
Yeah, because a clawback now is making a financial management executive get back the bonus. That's a clawback.
It struck me as nidocorific. Yeah. Interested in homophones and sound play, and it's all from your course, sound states.
Well, it's satirizing, we'll all agree, it's satirizing the legal language associated with foreclosure and repossession.
Well, when she says may prose and property both die out, What I love is that prose confronts the multitudinousness, the multiplicity, the slipperiness of claws, and thereof.
So how radical is this prose and property? Get rid of prose. Down with prose and property. Up with peace. How radical is this?
To me, it's also the idea of our assumptions about property, especially thinking about a female and property, that for a female to own something, you would need to own it with a man. Or that Nitaker, I think, was given some property by her mother. So in fact, she was one of the haves rather than the one right down among them. And I think as a woman, being able to negotiate these terms in those times, to me, that's what's radical, that she feels like she doesn't need Al or anyone next to her doing this, that she's gonna make claims herself.
Tell him to take my bare walls down, my cement abutments, their parties thereof, and claws of claws. Leave me the land, scratch out the land. May prose and property both die out, and leave me peace.
I hear a Dickinsonian ratio. I'm gonna say what it is and then invite anybody to comment. The Dickinsonian ratio is propertied. Being propertied. Propertied is to prose, as foreclosed is to poetry. May prose and property both die out. The implication is what's left is not prose. Prose would be the legal prose, but also just what prose does. Prose does a lot more denotating and pointing things and owning.
Quantifying.
And objectifying. But so propertied is to prose as foreclosed. You know, if you want me, I'm a poet. Go ahead and foreclose me. And the reason I'm thinking of Dickinson, of course, is House of Possibility, a fairer house than prose, right? It is a house. It's an impossible house. And she knows it's fairer than prose. It's the house of poetry, which is a house that doesn't have a roof. It's a house that has weird doors and windows. Anybody want to comment on this? I think it's Jessica's turn.
For me, that sort of concept that poetry is what's left is what makes a line like claws of claws a good and useful line in the poem, because it is highly poetic of all the lines. It's the one that's not just speech, not just prose. It's working in a different register with different tones, playfully thinking about language for us.
Creates an association of poetry with just what's left.
And you can challenge contract language with poetic language directly.
That's what I think is really key here, that this is very fussy, mean, judicial language that says this is mine, and that exactly that is yours. And basically she's saying here, may both prose and the proper leave me peace, my peace.
Michelle, let's go to Wilderness. So it was originally Wild Man. That's how she recorded it. It became Wilderness. Which title do you think is best for it? It's kind of a silly question, but...
That's a hard question. I like knowing that there's both and knowing that, you know, there is a revision possible.
So what does Wild Man mean as distinct from Wilderness?
To me, it points like a deictic. It points to that particular partner of hers or the imagined partner. We could think of her partner, Al. We could think of Zukovsky, or we could think of an imagined other. And I think it gives, you know, it's not just the land that's wild and can't be conquered, but also perhaps you live with this man and it's a foreign object, place, map. You don't know.
It's wilderness itself.
Yeah.
Jessica... there's a conceit here. It's kind of an extended conceit. You know, you are my other. I find it hard going. There's prickly pears. There's sudden violence. Where are we in the conceit?
That's the question, I think. And the title is an interesting way to think about it. It could be a very boring sort of thing. You're difficult. You, my other, are hard to know. But if it's a person, the where is quite difficult.
There's a conceit of the man being another country. What kind of country is it?
Violent, unpredictable.
Well, where does prickly pear grow?
Well, it grows in the Southwest. It's arid. It doesn't quite match.
This looks like arid, mountainous West. Hard going suggests hard to walk. Prickly pear and sudden
it's
violent
desert.
Storms. And
what
happens when the storm comes? This is a terrain with a culvert or a chase that with a sudden runoff of rain. This is the West.
You are the man. You are my other country, and I find it hard going. You are the prickly pear. You are the sudden, violent storm, the torrent to raise the river to float the wounded doe.
So why would we have an extended conceit where her man is like the West? Any thoughts, Dee?
There's another poem that I think is very interesting, in which she talks about men, a man getting out of a car. You are my other, you are the forest, you are the woods. And she claims the swampy, as she would, swampy, watery swale where she lives. But this is much more of a pushing to an extreme of that and almost blowing it up at the end. The tone at the end, I think, is very... takes you back.
Except that the wounded doe, Michelle?
That wounded...
Another Dickinson.
Yeah. Well, another Dickinson, but also another one of the most amazing moments I had in graduate school in Dee's class when we talked about the poem by William Stafford.
Oh, yes.
So I'm not saying that she's reclaiming that masculine, I'm overseeing this dead deer and I'm going to tell you how it is from the top of the mountain, but... You know, I don't think she's using the wounded doe as a metaphor. I don't think she sees a wounded doe, but in fact is just trying to figure out this other.
Well, I hope she's not the wounded doe, but in My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun, it's not clear that the Dickinsonian speaker is a wounded doe, but it's sort of the case. So is it possible that the speaker is the wounded doe in the end? The one that floats up dead when this violent sudden storm erupts and no, Michelle's shaking her head.
I personally can't don't like to think of Nitocker in those ways. I mean, I just like to think of her as like strong and pushy and pointing and urgent and you know, I would prefer not to think
well,
of her as
well. What's her relationship
the
wounded doe? Is she trying to rescue it? Is she sympathetic?
She's observing it.
Dee, what's the speaker's relationship with the wounded doe at the end?
Nitocker strikes me as always turning a quarter turn than where you think she is. No, so the wounded doe, my first reading would be, well, oh, that's the feminine and is being saved by the male. And
or not saved because it's floating dead probably if it's
well,
stuck
or,
in the torrent.
Or is pulled up onto its feet and made to move.
Mm, okay.
But so I think that the overstatement of float the wooden wounded doe is a way of distancing herself from it. To float the doe, it is pulled up on the sound. And again, here there's no period. So from that, it's wounded, not killed doe. Mm.
Jessica, what are your thoughts on this?
The doe?
Or any of it.
I'm still stuck on the concept of country being the line that really
you
takes
are
it
my
from,
other country.
From being just a love poem or anti-love poem, a you and I poem. Exactly. What does it mean to have a country and what does it mean to have an other country? There's a belonging to your country. There's a shared linguistic and cultural history, ethnicities, what all these things. But so how do you have an other country? Is it a country you belong to? Is it a country that you visit? Is it a country you feel equally comfortable in? It's Very,
you know, we put your comments together with Dee's comment about, you know, Nitteker, when she does landscape, associates herself with swampiness. This is the, you are my other country. You are my non-Laurian country. This
is non-Wisconsin.
I'm water. You're the desert.
Wild man.
I'm marsh.
So when I'm with you, we have a we live in different countries, and I find it hard going to be in your country. What's happening with the, why wild man as opposed to wilderness? They are different.
I think that's another way in which she's making this non-formulaic in terms of gender. It would be easy to put it out into a binary, but for her to have a country, it has to be distinct from another country. So her propriety, her properness depends on this not her. Which who she's married to. I mean, if it's about Al Millen, her husband.
It's definitely not about Al Filreis.
No.
Did
all
she,
this talk about
I
Al.
Suddenly heard that. Yeah.
Did she title the poem, do we know, Wilderness, or was that a...
Well, we heard the title in the recording, Wild Man, and I presume she... I bet Jenny's footnotes tell us, and I stupidly didn't look them up.
I read that she did send... both of these poems to Zukofsky, so I know that Zukofsky read them. Hmm. That's interesting. Hmm. I wonder if Al read. I mean, and did Zukofsky think he was the other? I hope he did.
So I want to go around, before we get final words, I want to go around and ask each of you to see if you were to be told, you know, teach your students Nitteker from these two poems, what would you be teaching those students generally? What do these poems tell you about, these two poems tell you about Laureen Nitteker's poetry? Michelle?
Well, I would definitely, and this is, I would always just go to the objectivists and teach, how is this not what we would expect from poems? How is this not confessional? How is it not I-centered? What other work is she trying to do?
Good. Jessica, these two poems, what do they have in common that would allow you to teach someone who doesn't know Nitteker?
One thing that's often said about Nitteker is that she uses very condensed language, very simple language, or seemingly simple language, pared down to just what needs to be there. And I think both of these poems come pretty close to that.
Dee, your thoughts on that?
The paring down, that's a good way of talking about it, always comes to another flinty layer. And so each time she pares down, she, in a sense, queers the ideas. She makes the ideas strange. She makes them other. So she's constantly depending on otherness to push her forward, which I think is a very interesting shift from wild man to wilderness. That for me, that I
becomes
prefer,
about the land, well, rather it than becomes, about the man,
or it becomes about wildness, not wild man.
Right.
So there's some part of her, in her compositional practice, that's wild, that's rogue, that won't rhyme things right.
Yeah, there's not an algorithm that will write these poems for you.
Yeah.
That it's her kind of folk strain or her surreal strain, in a way.
I would throw in this, I'm taking my cue from Susan Howe's reading of Emily Dickinson and her focus on the frontier and on wilderness. That is Howe's focus on the way Dickinson handles that. And I think both of them ultimately about what's at the edge of land and property and what we own and what we live on. In the first case, obviously, she's interrogating the way in which we own or don't own land and how people can take things away from you and not really take them away from you. And what's left in the end is poetry. And I think that's what Howe taught us about Dickinson. In Wilderness, what she winds up doing is sort of marking out the country and, as you suggested, the breaking down the binarism of my country, your country. So that, and we have the wounded doe there, which just so reminds me of Dickinson's troubling of any kind of binarism. Mm-hmm. Which would be gendered there, and also about violence, and also about what you do to command the frontier. So I think both poems are kind of about the edge of the wilderness in a way. All right, so we could go on forever about this. What I'd like to do is invite each of you to say one last thing. It could be very particular about either of the poems, a line or some part of the conceit, but let's just put some more stuff into the record. Michelle, last thought on this?
One of the things I did after reading these poems was look through the collected to find all the mentions of property. I was just sort of interested in the ways she talks about property. Some of the other lines, "Don't tell me property is sacred." I thought that was really beautiful. So that she is, she also has property as poverty. So she's definitely working out something about property that, as Dee was saying, and you were saying, is not settled in this poem. She's going to take it up again. This is not her only idea about property.
Nice. Jessica, final thought?
Unrelated to anything we spoke about, I think I had never listened to that recording, and I guess the only recording. Her voice is so small, and it matches the work, and yet it doesn't, because I think of her as so large, and it's a strange, jarring. She sounds tiny and young, very strange.
I don't know that she ever gave a public reading.
I don't think she did.
That she doesn't take this work and put it before the public. But what strikes me about a poem like Foreclosure is the incredible tonal nuance. She starts out like a bully, tell him, get out of there. And then she mentions the abutment. You know, if they're going to take her concrete abutment, they have to come in with jackhammers, and you just do that, right? But then she gets cute, the parties thereof and the claws. But then she gets into a serious editorial adjustment of the lexicon. And then, Al, like you said, it becomes a kind of lyric prayer at the end. Leave me peace. Mm. Eve. Like that.
Yeah.
So it's just what strikes me about both of these poems is how incredibly nimble they are, and how, like a deer, they're just always ahead of you.
Yeah. So many of her poems start with a refusal. Don't tell me to do this. Don't advise me this way. You think I'm this, but I'm not that. And then it kind of becomes some kind of adjustment, as you say, to the situation at hand. She seems like the kind of poet who can adjust to anything. And that makes her, rather than weaker, stronger, I would say.
Kind of like an engineer poet. Like, she's always engineering and making the rooms bigger and smaller.
Well, thank you. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us, probably two, but if you're real quick, maybe three, a chance to spread wide our narrow Dickinsonian hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Michelle, what would you...
So since we're in the writer's house, one of my favorite places on Penn's campus is the place where I met two young poets studying at Penn. Their names are Trisha Lowe, Cecilia Corrigan. They both have amazing books. Trisha's just came out. It's called The Complete Purge. Cecilia's will be out, and it's called Titanic. If you want to see the kinds of poets the Writer's House can produce, these are the ones to look at and to watch and listen.
Yeah.
For.
And you have to be really ready to read Trisha's book.
You guys are ready. You Poem Talk listeners are ready.
Okay, great. Jessica Lowenthal, Gather Some Paradise.
Since we've mentioned Dickinson a number of times, I'm glad... To mention Gorgeous Nothings, Emily Dickinson's envelope poems, edited by Jen Bervin and Marta Werner, which
Beautiful
is
book.
Amazing. It's so pretty, but it's also just fascinating to see basically how Dickinson was writing on envelopes, in particular scraps of paper, folding and unfolding them, refolding them. It's a stunning thing to look at.
Yeah, Dickinson keeps surprising us. You'd think that just when we were done with surprises. Dee Morris, Gather Some Paradise.
Here's a poem from New Goose. She had tumult of the brain, and I had rats in the rain. And she and I and the fur-lined man were out for gain. She, I think, would be, or makes me think of at any rate, Emily Dickinson. Rats in the rain makes me think, of course, of Nitocher. And the fur-lined man, what is that? That's what I love. There's where she escapes.
Thank you. Well, that's all the dying out of prose and property we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Jessica Lowenthal, Michelle Taransky, and Dee Morris. and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, as always, the same Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, David Abel, Amy King, and Mythili Jagannathan join me to talk about Muriel Rukeyser's The Ballad of Orange and Grape. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another episode of Poem Talk.